You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Julian, I've called you to review Dark Crystal with me. Are you prepared?
You just went from Frank Oz to Mark Hamill. So basically, you just saw half of this TV show right there.
That's my problem with voice acting. I always slip into whatever the dominant voice is.
It was like, ooh, that's a credible Frank Oz. Or actually Simon Pegg in this new version. But that should probably give our audience a clue as to what we're reviewing.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
I was trying to think of what was the Gelfling response I could say, but I couldn't talk with my mouth open that wide.
Well, no, you just got to do a Taron Egerton voice, just like, "Oi, I gonna talk about the Dark Crystal."
Just look at someone with a dead, glassy stare.
My lips never touch, but I talk to you like this.
So, hey, everybody, this is The Dark Crystal, The Age of Resistance on Netflix. Now, this is really, really impressive. Even just outside of what we have to say about the show itself, when you think about how much work it is to make a puppet, a puppet-focused TV show, 10 episodes, all about 40 minutes to an hour apiece, with the same director behind it the entire time, that is just insane. This is an insane level of production that they do for the show.
Oh, for sure. This is really a Herculean accomplishment on the part of Louis Leterrier, a director I never thought I would use those words to describe, but
famed director of The Incredible Hulk.
That's right. The good one with Edward Norton. Wait a minute. That's not the good
one.
No,
yes, the good one. No, it's the good one. You're right.
I would argue the good. It's not a flawless movie, but it is the good one compared to
the other.
It's the
second mediocre version of The Hulk.
Well, you know, that's the thing. When I look at Leterrier's background here, for people who don't know, he did the first Transporter movie. He did Now You See Me, The Incredible Hulk, The Brothers Grimsby, but we'll not talk about that one because it sucks balls. But that's the thing. Like, I can say this for Leterrier, where I think his movies themselves, they're not great, but he has a certain style, the way that he shoots action, the way that he edits, the way that he, the way that he immerses you into the scene. And I think that really, really worked for this show. To make it not feel like those old Jim Henson stories where it's like, yeah, Jim Henson usually just shoots them on a flat surface, like a flat screen and a flat shot. Here, it really feels like he's shooting actors and shooting people in these shots.
Well, you also have to take into account the advances in technology. So a lot of times what Jim Henson was doing, and I always kind of conflate those two because I think there's a lot of similarities between Jim Henson and George Lucas. I kind of put them on the same level.
I'm sure, yeah.
In terms of just creative geniuses who are innovators in their own respective fields. But a lot of times, with puppetry, it's a magic trick. And like any magic trick, you have to be very careful about the sight lines. It's about misdirection. It's about what the audience doesn't see, namely the puppeteer. What Leterrier has going into this new version of Dark Crystal is not only his own natural style, which is more dynamic than Jim Henson's, a lot more modern in tone, but he also has the ability to use CG not to necessarily create characters, but to make the puppeteers disappear. And so now he can actually move the camera around with a lot more fluidity, whereas in the past, in 1982, if you move the camera an inch, you'd see Frank Oz's butt sticking out behind of a prop puppet going, oh, no, we got to reset this because we can see Frank in the shot now.
Yeah, very reminiscent of someone like Guillermo del Toro's work, where they're hardcore about practical effects, but they make sure to touch it up with some CGI, which is not a bad thing, especially in something like this.
Yeah, this is way to do it. And the argument for doing practical is usually because it has more tactile feel, it looks more realistic. But I think that actually misunderstands what Henson was trying to do and what Leterrier and all this new group of artists are doing, which is very, very respectful towards what Henson did, which is he's not trying to make you think it's realistic. Yes, they're puppets. Yes, they don't move perfectly. Yes, they are obviously artificial, and yet when you are in that experience, you just buy it. That first episode, it took me a while to retrain my brain, but after a while, you just stop looking at them as puppets. They're just another real thing in this real world that is completely fantastical.
I think that I noticed that in the first episode too. Like, there was a lot of moments where it was out of sync, or the mouths of the Gelflings didn't correlate with what they were saying. And I think that they got better as they went along, because they started doing what you mentioned already, man, which is they figured out good angles. And some characters, I gotta say, it was interesting. A lot, like, the only ones that I would say I had issues with at all, and it's minor, is the Gelflings. Like, their mouths, I thought, were the biggest issues of all of them. And a lot of people have been telling me it was for the sake of nostalgia, but fuck nostalgia. Like, well, I don't see the point of making it shitty on purpose.
No, they didn't make it shitty on purpose, but that has always been the difficulty of the Gelfling puppet. I mean, imagine, it is basically a very elaborate sock puppet. It's a hand inside a piece of plastic, and somebody's moving their fingers up and down to move the lip. So you have very limited articulation. They did use some CG to add some blinks and to add some subtle modulations to the features. But even Jim Henson wasn't thrilled with the original Gelfling effect.
The blinks,
and they're harder because they are the humanoid characters. So we're going to judge them a lot more harshly than, say, the Podlings, which don't have any more or less level of articulation in their face. But because they're, you know, Bruegel peasants who look like they're made out of potatoes, you don't question the fact that their lips only do one or two things.
But it seems natural the way that the sound comes out of their mouth, is what I'm saying. Like, that's my problem with the Gelfling. It just doesn't look natural the way their mouth moves and the way that I hear the sound.
I mean, you know, and that's the thing. They're all done in post, but we should actually explain a little bit what the plot is before we get to this talk.
It does have a plot.
Yeah, so, Julian, why don't you give us a quick little synopsis here? Like, what is the gist of, like, setting up the story for this?
Let's see. So, basically, it's about these little Gelflings. They're these weird little elves, and they're ignorant as fuck. They do not know what's up, and these creatures who are reminiscent of a witch crossed with a zombie bird known as Skeksis, they are just abusing them and using them to just be lazy and be super rich. And the whole plot develops when one of the lead characters, Arya, am I saying that right? Like, a lot of the names and words in this
Rian?
Are like goof. Rian. There you go. Yeah, there's a lot of...
Arya. Wait, you confused Arya from Game of Thrones with Rian?
Dude, first of all, I never watched Game of Thrones, so let me just throw that out there. So I'm just like, one of my things about this, like, I like it, but at the same time, I think it's silly. It's like there's a bunch of gooblegorp, like made up words, and all these names are fucking weird. Like, they're going to hurrah. But just to finish what this is about, this Rian, he sees something happens to him where he says, okay, these Skeksis are lying to me, and it's all about getting out the truth. Tell the truth, Justin. Tell the people the truth.
Tell the truth. Yeah, and that starts off a major quest, because it mostly focuses from the perspective of the three lead characters here. We got Rian, we got Deet, and we got Bria, the three leads, and that's being played by Taron Egerton, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Nathalie Emmanuel, which, speaking of Game of Thrones, that's, what's her name from Game of Thrones?
It's, I know who she is. She's,
Missandei. There we go. Yeah, and that's what I love about this, first of all, is that, on top of everything else we're saying about the technical work and that stuff, there's a humongous list of voice actors.
Oh, yeah, it's
like,
stacked.
Not just voice actors, but, like, A-list voice actors, too.
I mean, you got...
Like,
That was one thing that kind of, like, at first, the first episode, noticing that it was out of sync, I looked into it, and it was because they had other actors originally playing all these characters, and they redubbed it afterwards. Because
the thing is that it's the puppeteers play the characters.
Yeah.
But they already had a cast set before that. You know, that's the thing. Like, the puppeteers animate the voices in terms of the actual emotions and that such, but then they know going in that they're not going to be the voices of the characters on stage, on the final product.
Lena Headey is not ever going to be a puppeteer. She's never going to be on set for 12 hours with a puppet doing the lines.
I get that. Yeah, I get that, but I would have thought that it seemed like that they did it after the fact, because why wouldn't they have had them
record
the lines first?
Because the puppeteers are actors. If you look, they're not animators.
I understand.
They are driving the performance, and if you actually watch the little, I don't know if you had time, I highly recommend it, the little behind-the-scenes featurette, Simon Pegg and Lena Headey and Jason Isaacs, they're all going like, well, yeah, we're actors, and we kind of know what we're doing, but we're watching the puppets, and there's an energy, there's decisions made, and it's not like animation where the animators listen to the actors and animate to that. They're honoring what the puppeteers do. So I'm like, oh, I wouldn't have done it this big, but that's what he's doing, so I have to match it. And it's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be 100%.
And what yeah, you
it's,
just
it's like
said.
It's like dubbing anime, basically.
It's like anime. Where you have, it's exactly like dubbing anime.
Yeah, and I think that it would have been a better choice maybe for them to have the actors to talk more to the puppeteers, because it seemed like there was a little bit of a disconnect there. That's my
you're,
thing.
You're,
like,
there's a part
complaint.
Of your soul that is dead, and that's cool. You probably go to puppet shows or theater and go, this shit's fake. That's not real.
I mean, as an actor with 20 years of experience and someone who has done traveling productions, I can tell you I know when something is real and I know when something's fake.
I humbly apologize. I have a theater background, and usually it's film nerds who've never been in a theater. We're like, that's fake. It totally took me out of, like, well, you have to kind of imagine it. It's
like,
kind of
I'm taking a bit of work
on our part as the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'm taking this from the point of view of a filmmaker and an actor, and my view is that I can see the strings more than I care to, and I don't want to just give it a blank, perfect review, you know, because it came off as a flaw to me.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, see, that's the thing. Like, it didn't bother me too much with that, but that's also because I know, again, the elaborate lengths they have to do to animate and voice these characters. I mean, first of all, it's obviously going to make better sound quality if you have the actors doing it in post-production like that, because, you know, recording on set with all the other moving parts and gears and that stuff is going to, you know, sound terrible in the long run. But here's the thing, too. So for people, you know, again, for other people listening here, this is based on the movie that Jim Henson did. And what I do like a lot about this, like, one of the biggest things I can say to praise this, they keep true to the spirit of the original movie, but they add so much more depth and lore and world building and character to everything about this, you know? This feels more alive than the movie. And again, I can't just nitpick against the movie because the movie is 35 years old. But this just feels even more alive than the movie did.
It feels like it respects the movie a lot. And any time where it was to maybe laugh at the movie or not mock isn't the right word, but it acknowledges what the movie is, and everything that this does is definitely only to respect the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's no other way it could have been done. I mean, not only is the Henson family deeply involved, but so is Brian Stroud, who was the illustrator who originally inspired this, and his wife, who he met on the original Dark Crystal, and their son.
And their son, who was the baby.
Who is now, you know, also involved on this. So it's really a family affair, and you feel that love in every stage of the production. Nobody's here just as a paycheck. There's definitely a sense of... That's why you have Simon Pegg and Taron Egerton and Jason Isaacs and Mark Hamill and Keegan-Michael Key. And, you know, and I could go on. Mark Strong, Benedict Wong, Harvey Fierstein, Awkwafina, Toby Joe. I mean, any movie with this cast. I mean, this is like two Marvel movies right there in terms of, like, you know, top quality. Natalie Dormer, Sigourney Weaver, Eddie Izzard, Ralph Ineson. Everybody wanted to show
Anna
up
John
to Kamen, do this.
Anna John Kamen, Alicia Vikander, Theo James. Yeah, Awkwafina.
I have a lot of positive to say about this. It's just that my little technical gripes, like, I just wanted to get that out of the way.
And
because
sure enough.
Other than that, it's really, like, an incredible sight to watch. Like, when I first turned this on, I was like, so what is this going to be, like, 6 episodes? I was like, oh, my God, they made 10 hours of fucking puppetry for Netflix? Like, it's a lot of work.
It's a hell of a lot of work. And I got to admit, that first episode, I was beginning to doubt it, because the first episode, which is the longest episode, it's almost a full hour. I think it's a little over an hour.
It's over an hour.
It is. And it is every 5 minutes, there's a new character, there's a new concept, there's a new plot detail. And they're really just doing a lot of table setting. They're putting all the pieces into motion. And I just thought, oh, my God, it's a slog. But really,
no,
by
I
two
agree.
Or three
yeah.
episodes in, it starts to click, because you also have, what we find out is that there's all these Gelflings, and there's these different clans, and each one of these clans has multiple characters that we get to know, and at first none of them share a scene. They all have a little piece of the puzzle that sends them off on an individual quest, and it's not only until like maybe two-thirds of the way that all these characters start connecting and putting the piecing the dots together and going, oh, you, this is what's going on. And once that happens, yeah, it really starts to find its groove.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to see what the Pulp Fiction of Dark Crystal would be, this is it.
Yeah. It's, you see, I keep calling it Game of Puppets because, honestly, this
also
is
accurate.
This is like, you know, if you love the original Dark Crystal from 1982 but wish that it had, like, more lore about the Gelflings, more palace intrigue with the Skeksis, and a runtime that's about 567% yeah, longer, well, boy, you know, all of your dreams just came true, because this has that, and I thought there's no way they can justify these many episodes at this length, and yet they actually make a very rich story out of this. I mean, we've barely touched the story, but if you're familiar with the original, there's going to be a lot of stuff here that you recognize, and I think if you're brand new to it, once you power through that first episode, I think you have the key concepts, and you can kind of, at that point, just kind of lean back and enjoy the story.
That being said, though, the first episode, there's a lot there to it, and if that doesn't hook you immediately, then maybe you just don't like puppet stuff and there's something wrong with you, you know what I mean? Like,
that's
possible.
I think that
there's a lot going on there, and one thing that I think we should touch on that's more important than talking about the plot is just how good the writing of all this is. Like, the dialogue in this is way better than I ever expected it to be.
It's very, like, deeply philosophical. It's very thought-provoking. It's pretty pensive. Very, like, it manages to cover such a gamut of emotions throughout the entire story. And it's all very traditional, like, storyline stuff. Like, you know, like the son who's following in the father's footsteps, and the daughter who wants to, you know, live up to the mother's harsh expectations, or the people who see the truth but are trying to convince people kind of thing. But it's all done so elegantly and very simply, too. Like, there's no, like, you know, it's not trying to give any pretensions about itself. It's just very honest, straightforward, but deeply emotional storytelling.
And it's consistent.
Yeah.
It really doesn't feel like, you know, this was written by this writer. Then this next scene, it has a totally different tone, and it doesn't reflect, like, what we just saw. Like,
Funny, because they're all written by different people, but it feels like they were all in sync with what they were doing.
Definitely.
Kind
of. No, there was definitely a lot of talk in the writer's room. I think these guys, you know, they cared about this world, and you have to. I mean, it's very, very... Here's my problem with reboots, because, goddammit, they have been rebooting my entire childhood, and I'm getting a little tired of it. I mean, I enjoyed my childhood, but I don't necessarily want to relive it. So when I heard, oh, fuck's sakes, a Dark Crystal reboot, prequel, whatever, I really was expecting the worst, because usually what happens is I get a filmmaker telling me, oh, we're going to respect the original, and then they go, yeah, we're going to throw all that shit out because that stuff wasn't any good. This is the new version and it's better. And I think you could make an argument that this is an improvement, but it's just different. I don't think it's necessarily better. They managed to do this neat trick of respecting the lore, building on it, and making a very modern television event that just happens to be set in this fantastical world that was, you know, established 37 years ago. And I almost feel bad for anybody who's going to see this and they're going to go, oh, I can't wait to see the original. And it's going to be a very different experience.
Yeah, and to be fair, I watched the original a month ago to get in preparation for this series. And I mean, I know it hasn't aged great in everything, but I will give respect that it was very ahead of its time and it's very Jim Henson.
It is.
So that's the thing, though. I feel like with Jim Henson stuff, I feel like outside of the Muppets, he has a very distinct style of doing his own solo projects that is good and ambitious and big, doesn't always work, though. And I feel like this one took those elements of what makes the stories good and just, like we said, it polished it a lot. It made a lot of unique changes and stuff to expand upon the lore and give it more depth and weight.
Yeah, and the original was a very fairy tale, new agey type of story. It was kind of basically like Jodorowsky for the don't do drugs era. So, like, if you imagine a Jodorowsky film, but no one ever does LSD and it's pitched towards children, you kind of get a sense of this gentle weirdness to it all. And it's very kind of cryptic in the way that if it were a storybook, you could probably read it to a child in, like, 15 minutes. And there's a whole lot of time where, because they built the world first, which is the difference here. That one is he literally found an illustrator and said, I want to work with you and I want to build a world. They built a world, then they put a story in it, which is a very simple story, but with this very rich background. And that's what really drives that. It's mostly a visual experience. I think the filmmakers here this time around know that they can still do that, but a modern day audience is going to expect something a little bit more involved. And to do it in a 10-hour format is, I mean, I don't know how much, I don't know how Netflix is still in business, because this is like a ballsy move. I can only imagine how much this cost.
Honestly, probably not as much as you think, because there's a lot of this that I would be very curious, and I bet you have the numbers, Justin. I'd be curious to know what they are, but whatever the amount they were given for this, they need more. Like, no doubt.
They need more? Oh, no, this is incredible. I mean, I'll take more.
I think that there's, like, 90% of this is really amazing looking. But then there's moments where it's like, that did not look as good as the previous time I saw this scene, or vice versa. Like, something won't look as good as it does another time. Like, it's just that sometimes seem cheaper than others.
I found that with some of the CG work, which I thought was usually good, but not always. But this is a world where everything is built by hand. I mean, that's the thing. You can't do it cheaply. I mean, you can do it affordably. You can do it economically, but you cannot do this cheaply. And they definitely got the money to do it. At least, if they got 90% of that vision, then that's better than most people do.
Oh, yeah.
I would say that the CG really, like, it's really good for, like, the background stuff, the faces, and some other movements. But the only time it was really weak was whenever characters were flying. Like, you can always tell, whenever people had, like, flying with their wing effects and that stuff, that was always very obviously green screen CG.
There is a scene where you're in Agra's, what's known as her orrery. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it properly, but it's this really cool contraption. It's basically a model of the universe, and it moves around. It looks so CG and fake, and it's really hard because that... We know that from the original. We know exactly. They built that set practically. And it's a major part of the movie. Here, for the series, it felt like, it's not that important. So we're only going to see it once or twice. Let's just do it in CG. It'll look fine. And it does it because every time you show me something that I've seen the real version of it from 37 years ago, it's going to suffer by comparison.
Sure, sure. But, you know, in terms of other stuff about the show, like, I think... On a technical level, aside from all the puppeteering stuff, like, visually, this looks great. It's shot by the guy who did the Paddington movies and a bunch of other stuff, like, in British independent films. And, like, on an aesthetic level, the color palette, the camera movements and that stuff all look really sharp and really clear in this. I think it looks great on a... I mean, it sounds great on an audio level. Like, oh my gosh, some of the music in here is really, really, really good in this. Also done by Daniel Pemberton, which he did the music for Into the Spider-Verse. For that movie. Yeah, it's got this very, like, otherworldly feel that's just right for a Jim Henson-style project, you know, with a lot of, like, metallic, kind of awkward factory sounds almost kind of thing.
Right, I mean, it's this weird thing where technically this is kind of sci-fi, but you never really think about the sci-fi elements. And it has that sort of medieval quality. You feel like you're in a world where... Anything with synthesizers would sound weird and harsh. You know, everything has to sound like, you know, it's played on an instrument that exists in that world. And yeah, to his credit, he manages to, you know, honor Trevor Jones or Jones' original score, which is, I think, a fantastic and often, I don't think that's a score that gets as much credit for how good it is. And so for him to do 10 hours of it without just recycling all of the themes and actually adding some new stuff is really quite an accomplishment.
Oh, yeah. And one thing I got to say, I mean, we've talked about this with our Nickelodeon reviews, Julian, but one thing I got to give so much credit for this show is dark.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Really, really dark.
And beyond that, dude, like, I was thinking, like, what if I had a kid, you know, it's like 3 years old and I tried to show him this? And then he discovers the Paladin character, who goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of this, talking a lot of that goofo ba-ba-ba dwarf type bullshit, like that's not even words. And I was having a hard time distinguishing when he was using real words and when he was speaking that made-up language. So could you imagine you have a kid, you let them watch this, and then their first word is like Gelfling or some shit? Like, and be
Oh, you're referring to
like,
Hup?
Is that
Hup? I love Hup.
I thought his name was Paladin. Brother Paladin, that's what I called him.
No, his name is Hup. He's a podlane, and the podlanes are basically like these little servant class, and he's like the one podlane who's like, actually, I want to be a knight, basically. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because they did develop a little language for him. It's a simple language, but I was never lost understanding him. I thought it's so pitched at a childlike level. You understand from his inflections what he's talking about. And when there's confusion, I think it's intentional for a laugh.
Yes.
And then he will mention a real word that you go, oh, okay. Because he's actually the only podling I think we've ever seen in the whole series who's like, I kind of know some of the English a little bit. He knows some pidgin English.
Yeah, like he learns English words as he goes along.
Yeah, he does learn. He's the only podling who seems to want to learn. The rest seem happy to just stay where they are and do the same thing over and over.
And not take baths, apparently.
And not take baths.
I guess when I wrote that down in my notes, I was just like, oh, warning, may have Klingon bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, I just didn't want there to be scenes where characters would be going, ba-do-da-ba, ba-da-ba-da. It's like,
I don't think your child learning weird words is the biggest concern you should have watching this movie. Because the original Dark Crystal fuck kids up. And this does, too. This is the thing I'm most proud of them. Because they could have gone that route where it's like, you know, that it was kind of weird and creepy, and we're going to tone some of that. Fuck no. They double down on it. I mean, their bodies in this movie or this TV show, and they're not only like people die, but people die terribly. And there's it's just that fine edge, because that was something, as you might have guessed, the original Dark Crystal did not do well. Originally, it was all in a made-up language, and they were like, no, Jim, nobody understands it. Redub the whole thing in English, and the violence is too much. Well, he got to keep the violence, which is why it's also so wordy in the original, because a lot of that is just dialogue they had. He thought that everyone would understand, and they're like, nope, put some narration so we know what's happening. But he didn't back off on the violence, because he had the idea. I mean, remember, Jim Henson is a guy who started off not doing stuff for kids. He evolved into that. But if you think about the work he was doing on Sesame Street and the Muppets, which was very educational based, very moral based, but he also thought kids need to be scared. It's good to be scared if you're a child.
Yeah, and plus the commercials he was trying to do when he first was coming up with Kermit were intense as fuck. Like Kermit would be like,
oh, the Wilkins coffee.
Yeah, you want some Wilkins coffee? No? Bang.
I mean, I do love that he had that side to him, and that was the big gamble with Dark Crystal, because people thought they would only see puppet movies if they were the Muppets, because by that point, you know, the Muppet movie had been out, and, you know, the Great Muppet Caper. This was really, I think, only his second film that he ever directed, and, you know, he would be dead in like about 8 years later. At the age of like 52, 53. And it's really a shame because for better or worse, Dark Crystal is kind of his masterpiece just by default. But I do think that had he lived, he would have, you know, picked up on some of those mistakes that Julian pointed out and said, you know what, I can do this better the next time. And the thing is, he did every time. He did learn. That's also why there's human characters in Labyrinth, because he's like, we're not doing an all-puppet show. It's too damn hard. But I do think that had he been alive today, he would be utilizing this kind of technology, even if it was just CG to erase puppeteers. But this was a guy who was never going to be a purist and only do the same thing over and over. And in that, more than anything, that's what this new series honors, that spirit of innovation that Jim Henson brought to every project.
Before we move off from the violence, because I think that merits a little bit of a discussion, there is stuff in here. I literally wrote it down in my notes. I was like, all right, this is starting to remind me of Midsommar. Like, this is, there is some graphic violence in there, dude, that comes out of nowhere where you're just like, whoa, okay? Like, are we going to ignore that everyone here is taking drugs? Like, some intense, there's stuff that, like, is reminiscent of, like, sexual violence in this. There is stuff that is really, like, out of place if it wasn't just so committed to it. If it just didn't,
I don't know about the sexual violence part, bro, but there is some very like the graphic death.
There
like,
is
even
the scene.
Well, I should say there was one death that happened very early on. That was the one I was like, wow, this is gonna traumatize some people. Even me, I was just like, geez, you murdered that dude hardcore in that one.
I don't remember where I wrote it down. Where it's pretty metal reminds me of Midsommar. But I would bet that it was around the part with a character losing an appendage.
Yeah. Okay. That. Yeah.
Like it was just very intense and just I just didn't see it coming. And as far as what I was referencing there is a part where the Skeksis are grabbing one of the Gelflings and shaking her around and she's screaming. And I'm sorry, seen a lot of art films. I know where that goes. It looked like there was a scene that was cut. And there is most definitely a scene where someone says, hey, pretty lady, drink this drink. And then she gives it to the guy, and he forgets everything. That's a fucking roofie.
It's basically it's the Thra version of Rohypnol. It's this magic leaf that makes you forget everything. Yeah, okay.
The best in Harar.
To be fair, nobody is using it recreationally.
Thank goodness.
But, there's definitely, even in the original, there's a moment where one of the characters, one of the Skeksis, the Chamberlain, he's cast out. And it's very frightening as a child where all of the other Skeksis attack him and you think they're going to pull him apart limb from limb. And then they pull back, and he's had pretty much all of his clothes. And it's this horrible naked strip bird thing. And you're like, why am I looking at a naked strip bird, and why is this so disturbing? Because it's not a rape scene, but it's like, we're ripping all your clothes off, and we're kicking you out. You're on your own now. He's got just enough to cover up the modesty. And that's the kind of thing that he was already doing in 1982. And it's really kind of fucked up. I agree that it's not sexual per se, but somehow Jim Henson knew how to get just close enough to get that PG-13 rating and let your childlike imagination wonder what just happened. And as an adult, you go, man, that's some really fucked up shit he was doing back then.
Yeah.
And thank God.
I'm shocked this show got a PG rating, to be honest.
This like, got a PG?
PG was very different back then, though.
Oh, no. The movie, I understand. But the show itself is PG, which I'm like, this is almost PG-13.
That's incorrect. This is PG-13.
See, but people...
Oh, is it? Okay, it always said PG whenever I
started playing. I don't know what it says, but I don't care. It's wrong.
In your mind, it should have been PG-13.
When I was watching it, I was like, this reminds me, in a way, The Dark Knight, where I can see someone pushing the boundaries of something where it kind of overcomes a rating, where it doesn't even... A rating doesn't even affect it. Like, if they said, okay, here's the line, don't cross it, it's like, that was never going to be a problem for them. But like, look at my notes, the one thing, because I want to shift gears into something more positive, because I think that there is a lot of underlying stuff that this had to say, and I wanted to touch on what you mentioned, the really horrifying death. There's a specific line that they say in the first episode, where they talk about how the crystal can drain you of life. And they use syringes for that metaphor. That's right on the surface, man. That's talking about drugs, kids. That's talking about drugs.
I guess.
The thing is, when you know, the syringes are used to extract. You're not injecting them, and no one's doing it voluntarily. It's not at all portrayed as a fun thing. But there is definitely a sense. And again, back to the original, same is true in this one. You don't have to ever use the word addiction, but there's definitely a sense that the Skeksis have become addicted to the power they derive from the crystal. And they're already pretty far gone morally, so once they realize that the crystal is running out of power, there's really nothing that's going to stop them from getting their fix. And, you know, that's where you get this sort of perversion of this life force. And you get a lot of the themes that Henson was bringing in, you know, which is actually a very environmental type film. You've got a kind of one percenter type of storyline here. This film feels oddly resonant.
For sure.
You know, and again, a government that has like convinced all of the people, like, I never thought I needed Gelfling racism before, but apparently in this new version, they're like, in the old version, you know, there was just Gelflings and that's all we knew about them. Now there's like, no, there's actually seven clans and they're all kind of low-key racist. They kind of don't trust or like one another. Oh, you're those weird green people who live underground. Can you even see? I mean, they're like, that's fine. I've heard all the jokes, you know. And it's a really rich development. Then the idea of like, hey, the Skeksis have created this society where they're at the top and we kind of have a pecking order and they've played us against one another to maintain that power.
And to go off of that, multiple times they touch on fucking immigration, where there is a wall in between where the people need to go and they're being turned away because they are different.
I still think that's a little reading too. Like, there, you can read that into that, but I don't think that was intentionally meant to be like any kind of commentary.
I think it was. Because
also, to be fair, this movie took like 6 years to be made, and some of the topics that are being discussed nowadays that you could see into this weren't really being discussed.
Right. Anyway, but I think the topics are universal. They may feel topical, but you know, it's this crazy idea. I mean, it takes a puppet maker maybe to make the idea of like, you know what? We shouldn't be mean to people just because they're different than us.
And that's the climate change thing, for sure, though, is there. That is definitely
again, there. I'm going more with Marco's side here, where I think that some of the topics here are not meant to be specifically political. They're just things that anyone can understand. Because I think you could show this to any age of person or any time, and this would hold up just as well then as it would now. Kind of.
Yeah, but like, you know, Henson was always about taking big themes. I mean, like death.
Sure.
Life and death. Literally, you know, it's... This all starts because you have one race of beings who just can't accept the fact that they're going to die. And you have this very hippy-dippy, trippy notion like, actually, you know, we live on the world and we all live, we all die. It's all part of this big circle. And, you know, we go back to the Earth and then the Earth brings more life. And the Skeksis are like, no, fuck that. We're just taking all that. We don't want to die. We're going to take everybody's life force away. But yeah, you can take some of that view, but it is a more general, universal, and I think ultimately very humanistic message that he put in the film. And it's been ported over to this, which I'm so grateful for, because I thought it could have just been, action movie with puppets. And they're taking not just his techniques, but his vision seriously.
Yeah. Well, and just to keep, you know, we're going a little long on this, so just to run down a few points. Like, I just got to say that, you know, we talk a lot about the Skeksis. The Skeksis may be some of the most terrifying creatures for puppetry I've ever seen in anything.
Yeah.
Like, especially... Even here, they are nasty and grotesque and violent and...
beautiful.
Oh, and they're beautifully designed. Like, all the stuff they did to animate them and they're... Like, oh my gosh. Like, anytime they show the Awkwafina character who's just pustulating and dripping everything, I'm just like, okay, I need to look down for a second because I'm going to throw up. But... And even then, like, they managed to give them so much character development. Especially, that's a lot of credit to give to the voice actors. Like, I gotta say... Most of the people you can kind of tell who's who. Like, you know, Taron Egerton is the main guy. You can tell it's him immediately. You know, Harvey Fierstein is one of the Skeksis. The instant I heard him, I'm like, oh, that's Harvey Fierstein. But the guy who impressed me the most with this stuff, who just disappeared, is Simon Pegg as the Chamberlain.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't tell that was
it
him.
Is,
I had to look
it's
it up.
The most recognizable character and voice in from the original. I mean, you started off, I was waiting for somebody to do it, and you started off the review with the little whimper that the Chamberlain is famous for making. Everybody knows that, exactly. And for Peg to nail it so well, I thought the person that they had doing Agra did a very good, also a Frank Oz character. So you have that thing of like, everybody's trying to recreate what they did before 30, 40 years ago. But still put their own spin on it. And part of that is, I think Julian pointed out this, that they just give them more to do than they did in the original.
Yep.
The Chamberlain was always kind of the smarter of the Skeksis, a little more politically savvy. Here you see that come to fruition, the way he plays everyone against one another.
Well, and the reason why we remember the Chamberlain in the movie was because he's the Skeksis with the most screen time compared to everybody else. So here, giving the Skeksis more to do, the other Skeksis more to do, really... fleshes out their
character. The science character, the scientist, played by Mark Hamill.
Oh, you mean the obviously Mark Hamill Joker?
They all sound like the Joker. But really, I mean, if you look at it, the moral of this movie is that the problem with the Skeksis and why they're doomed to fail is that they do not believe in multidisciplinary learning. They don't have any sense of cross-training. Scientist. Guess what he does? He's the scientist. If he dies, no one else can do what he does. And as we see, it's like, he built the armor, he runs the crystal, he figured out how to extract the life, he builds the Gartham. Yet they torture him every time he gets something wrong. I'm like, you should not be killing that guy until you've trained his replacement. This is why you guys are going to lose. Because you've only got one guy who knows how to do anything.
But anyways, like, there's also some, I mean, again, there's a lot I could say about this show. And honestly, when I think of the things I wasn't crazy about, because most of the stuff I have to say about this is like high praise. I think this is one of the most unique things I've seen on TV in a while.
Yeah, it better win Emmys.
Agreed.
I hope so too. But the only thing that I'm not crazy about this, like Marco said, the first episode was a little slow getting to its, you know, getting a rhythm because they introduced so many characters. And honestly, some of them look really similar to each other, so it's hard to tell at first who was who. And
if you think, what are you saying, like, Justin? Do all Gelflings look alike?
Oh, I knew we would go there. You're the kind of person who needs to see this movie, Justin.
Wow. But aside from that, there's only
Gelfling
one major sequence.
Gelfling lives matter. Just saying.
Oh, jeez. But there's only one thing that wasn't crazy about. There's an episode, I want to say it was either episode 7, I think, where they meet a character in the desert. Well, two characters. And while some of the visual ideas they did in that sequence were cool, the two characters, they spend a lot of time with those guys doing just, like, comedy bits and routines that wasn't... It went too long.
Agreed. Yeah. But the idea was great. The initial impulse. Oh, yeah.
Especially there's this one visual sequence they did with finger puppets. Yeah. Like, where the puppets do puppets, which was really awesome.
That was amazing.
Yeah,
that
but was the idea.
That's what made up for it for me. Because when you have character who talks really slow like that, it's going to slow it down in general. So they use that sparingly enough. Like, I only got like to halfway to episode 8, so I don't know if he makes a return, but
not really.
Yeah,
no.
So that's fine. Like, to have him come in and out, like, I think that was a very iconic character, and I thought that they did him like,
oh sure, the slow guy was fine, but it was the Andy Samberg character, which, just to say who it was,
he was the Skeksis, like, right? The abandoned Skeksis?
Yeah, that's the
but
thing.
The idea was more interesting, even though the execution, the idea that you have two characters who are, we've always known this from the original movie, that there's two of each of these characters, they have a twin, basically, an evil and a light side, and the idea of seeing two of them interact in a scene, that's something I never would have thought about from the original, and they put that in there. And I thought that was such a fascinating concept. These two guys going, yeah, you know, he's my good side, he's my bad side. Somehow we make it work. I wanted to see more of that, but I agree with you, Justin, that the way they used it wasn't always the most exciting, interesting way. It's the execution was not as good as the concept itself.
And even one of the characters falls asleep during that sequence, and I'm like, yep, I'm almost there with you, buddy. But otherwise, yeah, I gotta say that most of the stuff I have to say about this is great. Like, even, I remember mentioning to Marco, the times they do action in this show, admittedly, anytime you do puppet action in anything, it's gonna look kind of hokey and fake, because puppets can't fight, you know? They can't move like people.
Yeah.
But I will say, this is probably the best I've ever seen puppet action being done. Like, again, not flawless, it's very obvious that it's, you know, stiff, inanimate creatures fighting each other, but it's way more convincing than almost anything else I've ever seen.
And what's funny is the best shot of the action is in the trailer. I thought from what I've
seen,
I have to think which one.
I haven't actually seen the trailer in a while.
In the trailer, it's the scene where I'm gonna say his name wrong, Arian or whatever the fuck.
Rian.
He cuts the rope and he goes flying up to the ceiling, and he lands on the wall and climbs up. That shot is in the trailer, and that was one of the
actually,
best
actually, I think the best action shots happened in the last episode.
Okay.
Which I know Marco had a few complaints about, which, yeah, you haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Either, but I think some of the most awesome shots they did of, like, singular puppet action stuff happens at the very end of the show.
And so they're pretty clever about using slow motion in some parts. Like you guys mentioned the music being really good, and the music works for that, so I didn't like it. It all looks silly when you get down to it, but the fighting, I think that they frame it well enough that it didn't bother me.
Which is also amazing that Leterrier, the director, did all of the camera operating in this, insane. Which is insane.
He directed all 10 episodes. Nuts. I mean, it's, yeah, it's a lot of work. It's like making 5 very, very difficult feature films back to back.
If not 10.
No, not 10, 5. Okay. So think it's 10 hours, so think of 5 two-hour movies. It's sort of that level of work.
Ah, okay.
And it's and there's not look at everything in this world has to be built. Everything. I mean, there's never an easy day on a film like this or a TV show. You're never going to go, "Oh, thank God, it's the coffee shop scene. We're just going to go and shoot 2 guys in the coffee shop, do a little over the shoulder, a couple wides, and we're done for the day." It's like, no, this is the one with the Landstriders, with the guys on the stilts and the wires hooking them up, and the puppet with the 3 guys who have to be green screened out against the explosion stuff. And, you know, there's never an easy day on a shoot like this, is what I'm saying. No. And
I think that's one of the great things it's about impressive. This is that there's always something happening in this show. Like, it never feels like it takes a time to really slow down, except for like maybe 2 scenes. But there's always some complex or some motivated action that's moving the plot and the characters forward.
And any time it slows down, there's so much creativity falling out of this show's butt that it is just fascinating to watch. Like, you'll never see them put a lock on a door. Of course not. It's this dragon snake thing that's also
the lock snake.
Yeah, duh.
You know, of course that's what they would do, right? I mean,
and it was crazy. Making me think, I was like, this is kind of like that show Dinosaurs, which is also a Henson.
It's also a Henson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, it also ended rather bleakly.
Well, yeah, I mean, this one, I won't say too much, but there's some stuff in here where I don't know if this will be renewed for a second season, but I really, really hope it does. There's actually quite a bit of potential for the story here.
Yeah, you
if
could.
If not a series, just give me a Chamberlain movie, or just give the Henson Company a lot of fucking money to develop a new idea. That would also be awesome.
That would be nice.
Yeah, either way. But I think, honestly, in terms of stuff that's been released for Netflix this year, next to Stranger Things that came out in the summer,
trash.
This is one of the better things I've seen from Netflix this year.
But I mean, this is like nothing anybody else is doing. I mean, all of those shows are really good, but then you have like the puppet aspect. I mean, even David Fincher couldn't direct all 10 episodes of Mindhunter, and that half of that is just guys sitting in a room, you know, interviewing a serial killer. They're like, and he only did like 3 of those episodes. Again, I just return to the fact how hard everybody worked on this. I mean, that doesn't make a good movie just because you worked hard on it. It's nice to see that the effort put behind the scenes actually translated into a good final product.
Yeah. I want to see what David Fincher's Muppet movie would look like. That would be amazing.
I'm just thinking though now, like, how do you think that mouse feels about this? Like, I mean, Disney on the surface, or they would probably want that on Disney Plus, but I don't think that this would fly with the Disney execs.
Well, there's no way Disney would authorize anything with this on it.
They bought the Muppets. They don't want the Dark Crystal side of Jim Henson. They want the Muppets side of Jim Henson.
And I bet they regret it now.
Eh, I don't think they care too much. But we should probably start winding down a little bit, because honestly, you know, I'll start first just to start off the final thoughts, because I went into this apprehensively because I'm like, this looks really good from the trailers. I don't know how well it's going to translate to a 10-episode series. And that first episode, it did take me a while to get into the groove. But after a while, I stopped thinking of these guys as puppets. I actually started to think of them as characters. And even with anything, what you can say about lip-syncing or puppet movement and that stuff, I always felt very immersed in the world. And I was honestly very emotionally involved with some of the characters. Like, I love Rianne, I love Deet, I love Bria, I love Hop. They're all such distinct, interesting, and complex personalities, even with their little gimmicks and their goofy qualities, that I wanted to see how they would do stuff. And they even give a lot of stuff for the side characters to do. Like, even freaking Lena Headey gets a big supporting part in the story, it's funny where she, being Lena Headey playing Cersei in Game of Thrones, goes up against essentially the Cersei character in this show. So it's like, huh, it's a nice little role reversal for her. It's kind of fun. But yeah, I think this was really, really well done. I can't think of anything else I've seen this year that is like this show. It's just so... It's magical. It's really magical.
It's special. It is genuinely special.
Yeah. So I think in terms of a rating, just based on how much I just enjoyed myself watching this and on a technical, artistic, entertainment level, I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 shots of seeing how many times Sketsies pee.
Dude, their pee is fucking yellow. Like,
they have three streams of pee that go out at the same time.
That's because terrifying. That's because he felt young. He was peeing like never before. That's what I thought. Don't you remember? Well, don't you remember what it was like to pee when you were young, Justin? But I didn't
have three dicks.
Look, once you get past 40, you have to pee a lot, so it's really not all that excitement. Only that exciting, guys. I mean, come on.
Oh, Justin,
it's
our
like, oh, I gotta get up in the middle of the night, different. Go pee again. Woo! Feel like I'm young
but
again.
Only my second dick needs to pee, but that's right. I can wrap things up. Before I do my finishing remarks here, I had one quick question I wanted to ask you guys because we didn't mention my favorite part. What was one of y'all's like favorite like creatures that showed up that wasn't like a main character? Because one of my favorite parts in this, and I'll go right into my final rating or whatever, and then you guys can answer. But I loved those furry balls. Like that's
the Fizzgigs. Oh, yeah, I love the Fizzgigs.
When it showed up and she starts rubbing its belly. And then the other one popped up. It's like, what are you doing? Are you cheating on me? That was so fucking, that was so Muppets. And I loved that. And there's stuff like that throughout this show. The writing is super fucking clever. It has no right to be as good as it is. But here we fucking are. Technically, I think it's almost perfect. I think it's very good. It could be better. No, sorry. It's great. It could still be better. I'm going to give it 8.9 out of 10.
No, I think the Fizzgigs were definitely, even in the first movie, the Fizzgig was one of my favorite parts of that movie. Because it's just so cuddly.
Can I just say something about this? Okay, because Fizzgig, 1982, Fizzgig is Fizzgig. Now, 37 years later, they're telling me that Fizzgig's name was not Fizzgig. That's the name of his species. And I don't appreciate my childhood being retconned like that. So what you're telling me is Kira, in the original, basically had a dog whose name was Dog.
Yep.
Why? I was just like, it doesn't matter. It's not important. They're adorable. For me, Fizzgig was always a singular thing. That would be like watching Star Wars, and you go, oh, I love R2-D2, and then you realize that all of the astromechs are named R2-D2. It would just kind of take out some of the specialness of it.
If it makes you feel any better, for years, I thought that Chamberlain, that was the name of the actor, because I just never researched it. I was like, that's Chamberlain. Yeah.
Sure, there was some Chamberlains. Some well-known actors named Chamberlain.
Yeah, sure.
But in terms of, like, creatures, I guess, I mean, other than the Fizzgigs, I mean, all the creature design was really impressive in this overall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything is amazing looking.
Yeah, so I can't really say it. I could pinpoint any one other creature other than the Fizzgigs. I mean, even the Landstriders, which we saw from the first movie, you know, they're cool, but I've already seen what the Landstriders look like, so it wasn't... It didn't blow me away.
The new spiders are pretty cool.
Oh, the
because
FDR
they
them, yeah.
again they do this thing from Labyrinth where they had the hands. It's just a different kind of puppetry where they create faces with hands, the helping hands in that movie. And here they take that Jim Henson idea and just do something completely different with it, only with spiders. So I can't believe that's happening right now.
Yeah. Again, talking about stuff that's nightmare fuel. Like anytime the Arathem show up, you're just like, look, the way the plot goes with them is really unique, but just anytime they show up normally, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, all the puppets, I think the best puppet work was the spiders. Like, when they would move, I was like, that's incredible. Like, that is masterful work.
See, and I thought they were all CG until I saw some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Or Lore, the stone character. I thought, that's a total CG character.
Oh, no.
And then when I looked at him, like, oh, my goodness. Because I can usually tell. And part of it was just that he moves so fluidly. I'm like, I don't see how this is a puppet. And then when I see how they did it, and again, it's that trick of, look, you don't use CG to, you know, make the character come alive. You use CG to get all of the puppeteers out of the shot. And then they do the real work on stage. And it's just, again, what a bizarre asymmetrical design, I mean, of a rock monster. I mean, no one's ever seen a creature who looks like that, and it's incredible.
And the way that he talked, like, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And one other design I really liked was the Hunter, the other new Skeksis character they introduced. Yeah. Where it's funny, though, because that was the one that was so clearly a dude in a bodysuit. But they did enough where it wasn't too distracting anytime. Because it was whenever he did like the very complicated movements that it switched between CGs and a dude who's wearing just a hood, essentially, right. of the puppet kind of thing. But it was still really cool and really terrifying at points.
Yeah, a great new addition. And I did notice, and again, why I think they will have a second season. Look, one of the problems with any prequel is that if there's a character that is not in the original, I'm not going to get too attached to them. Whereas if there's a character who I do know from the original, I'm like, I'm never really stressed out about what's going to happen to them because I know they're going to make it. But still, there's still a lot of room to introduce new characters. At one point, they even go, shouldn't we call this guy? There's like a couple of other Skeksis names, and they're like, no, 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 we'll handle this ourselves. So there's at least two or three other Skeksis, I think, that we haven't even seen yet.
Oh, and they show some shots for what was clearly going to be what's in season two. Like, you know, stuff that's going to be, that's going to happen in the future. You're like, oh, I want to see what that goes, what happens, you know?
Well, some of that is stuff that's definitely looking like season two, and also from stuff that's going to happen in Dark Crystal, because Dark Crystal's later in the timeline, which is why we see the little Gartha. We see the Garthum in the flashbacks, or the flash forwards, or visions, or whatever you want to call them, because those are nightmare fuel creatures too, with their little weird chittering sounds and their big beetle-like carapace. I love the fact that this is so freaky and weird, and Jim Henson thought kids could handle it. And years later, his family and, you know, everyone working on this going, yeah, kids can handle this. I mean, shit, I saw this movie. It fucked me up. And then, like, a few years later, I was watching Verhoeven's RoboCop. Nothing fazes me anymore. But we turned out okay. I mean, playing, you know, video games, did it make me violent? And seeing really weird, creepy stuff, did it make me necessarily weird or antisocial? It just gave me a different outlook on things. And that's why, to what Julian was saying, should it even be PG or PG-13? I think PG-13 is such a kind of cop-out half the time, rating-wise.
Sure.
Because, you know, why even bother? But to me, this is exactly something that a child should watch. Maybe not the youngest, but, you know, I'd say at least from the age of 8 on, they'll be fine.
Yeah, kind of like older child and preteens.
Stuff. Yeah.
I don't know. Ever since I showed my... Well, I don't want to, like, go on a rant after until you give your rant, but I'll say this real quick. Ever since I showed one of my cousins when he was, like, 13... He was, like, 11. I showed him the first Planet of the Apes movie, and when Caesar jumped at one of the people, he ran out the room crying. I was like,
that
was fucking awesome. Was that the Andy Serkis one?
Yeah.
Oh, you should have shown him the original Planet of the Apes movie. Then he'd be fine.
Yeah.
You just show him the old ones, you know, with
Charlton
Heston. But
that
one
is rated PG-13, and that was my point. But go ahead.
Well, that Planet of the Rise of Planet of the Apes is PG-13, too. So you showed him a PG-13 movie either way.
How old was your child at the time?
He was like 11, something like that.
Well, there you go.
You know, in 2 years' time, he would have been fine. But I'm sorry, I actually, until Julian reminded me, I haven't given my rating. I apologize. I thought we'd done.
No, go ahead.
So I will wrap my rating up. Again, we've already covered a lot of it. I think this is a leap forward in terms of puppet telling, storytelling via puppetry. We don't see it very often. There's good reason for that. Not a lot of people are willing to commit to it. I think this manages to not only bring something fresh and new to the genre, if you want to even call it a genre in itself, and more importantly, it pays honor to Jim Henson, a man we lost far too soon. I wish we could see what he would have been making to this day. But I think he would be proud of what these guys have done here. This is a hell of an accomplishment.
Definitely.
I have to give this 9 out of 10 eyeball-eating beetles.
Oh. Again, talking about stuff that will mess people up when you see that stuff. And I also say, too, that IMDb, for people looking at the IMDb page, it'll list, like, how many episodes each of the actors are in. Don't believe that. Don't get too attached to some of the supporting characters. Let's just say that for sure. It's very misleading.
Look, I'm not going to spoil a 37-year-old movie. I'm just saying that 1982's The Dark Crystal, not a lot of Gelflings in it.
Just saying. Yeah.
It's a very small population of people in that movie.
Well, maybe they're all just underground, and you haven't seen the end.
they might do that. I mean, hell, they've retconned what fizzy gigs are, so I guess they can retcon what happened to all the damn gals. They were all living in Groton this whole time. They did it.
See, I will say this too. I'll just say this too. One more thing on that note. Mild, slight spoiler. There's a couple things here that they clearly retconned compared to the movie.
Oh, sure. Like,
are they going to rectify that in season two? Or that's a huge thing to change and not address at all.
Yeah.
You know, later on.
I mean, this actually picks up later than I thought. I thought they were going to go further back to before the Skeksis and the Urus separated. I thought that would be the plot. But nope, they're like, that happened 1,000 years ago. So not only could they make sequels, and that blew my mind, not necessarily in a good way. I was like, oh, fuck, why are you leaving a sequel open? I just wanted this to transition right into Dark Crystal. You know, no one will ever let a story end anymore. Not only have they set up the potential for a sequel, they've also set up the potential for more prequels. I mean, goddammit. Just You're end damn the right. story already.
No, not when your rock monster with a record player on his arm can make you billions of dollars.
Wax
no,
cylinder.
I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that was
that weird use of technology, a stone stylus. I mean, again, the imagination at work here is we haven't even touched a tenth of it. Every shot of this has like an idea or an image or a character design that in any other show would be the highlight. Here, it's like, oh, that's just a thing that's in the background, you know? Why does he do this? Oh, we just have to get through some exposition, so we'll just do it this way. And like, that's amazing, and then you never do it again. That's incredible that you came up with that.
Could you imagine if cars, though, were like the things that they use and the Skeksis use? Like, oh. Like all four of our tires are these little animals sitting like, I'll fucking electrocute you, now run when I get on the highway, okay?
Oh, the armadillo pill bugs that are the wheels in this universe. I'm like, I don't know where they got electricity, but they do, and that's fine. Yeah, it all makes sense, you know?
Like, thank God we never saw them get a flat. That would have been fucked up.
Right, I didn't see them bring a spare.